A diagnosis of breast cancer can cause a life-changing ripple effect of impact, affecting those we love the most and those upon whom we lean for comfort and strength in the most challenging of times. My name is Aisling Hurley. I'm the CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland, and you're listening to More Than a Lump, a podcast that talks openly and honestly to a selection of guests about their very personal connections to breast cancer, be it through their career choice, their own first-hand experience of the disease, or through sharing the experience of close family members. My conversations will centre on how breast cancer has informed their perspective on life, love, family, health, their goals, and indeed aspirations. Although each story is utterly unique, the one common thread that runs through each one is that breast cancer is more than a lump. This episode of More Than a Lump is proudly supported by Care Plus Pharmacy. Care Plus is Ireland's leading community pharmacy brand, offering expert advice and services for a healthier and happier you. You can find your nearest Care Plus on careplus.ie or follow them on social media for daily health and wellness tips. When Paul Gallagher's wife Marie died from breast cancer in 2007, aged just 46, he had to raise their three daughters, Amy, Kate and Sophie, on his own. At the time of Marie's initial diagnosis back in 2002, 5 years earlier, the girls were just 13, 10 and 6 respectively. In this episode, Paul joins me along with Kate, his middle daughter, to talk about their beloved Marie and to reflect on the past 20 years, the low points, the high points, and in particular, the recent birth of first baby grandchild, Ruby Marie, and also indeed Kate's wedding. If you think you might find the topic of loss and bereavement too upsetting, you may wish to skip this episode of More Than a Lump. Paul and Kate, you're very welcome to our little studio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Asha.
Paul, you and I have known each other for a long time, and when I spoke to the team in Breast Cancer Ireland about covering the topic of bereavement and loss in our podcast, I knew that your story and your experience of that of your beautiful daughters would be something the listeners of this podcast might wish to hear about. It's a sad story, but also a story of resilience, hope, and getting on with things for sake of the people you love and in memory of the woman you loved. Paul, maybe take us back to that trip to Spain, New Year's Eve in 2002, when yourself and Marie were getting ready to go out for a party with friends. There were five families, I believe, all together, and Marie felt a lump in her breast in the shower.
Yeah, that's correct, Ashton. I can't remember what particular day it was, other than it was New Year's Eve, and we'd all booked into a sort of a local Chinese restaurant, and all the families were looking forward to the evening, so the girls, I remember them small, running around, getting themselves ready. And, Marie went in to have a shower and she came out and she was crying her eyes out. Still see her standing there. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, I have a lump on my breast. In fact, I think I have two. So she said, I can feel something here. And I said, if you don't mind, I'll have a little feel myself.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, no point in panicking. I said, there's nothing we can do about it now, I said, except we can make a phone call back home to Dublin. And we phoned our family doctor, Dr. Hastings, and we spoke to him. And he said, look, when are you back? We said, in 2 days' time. He says, come in to me straight away and I'll do a test on you and I'll see what it is. It may be no more than some sort of a cyst or whatever he had said. And So we went out that evening. It was a bit stressful and a little bit sad. But we did have a sort of a good evening as best as we could. And then the rest is history. When we came back, Marie went to see Dr. Hastings. He duly booked her into hospital to get a test done. And from there, we were in St. Vincent's at the time, and then we were called in and we met with Professor Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through the position with us. Mm-hmm. I can remember the little rooms that we were in, the back end of the hospital, not the side of the hospital, in the Vincent's private. And we went in, it was a Wednesday afternoon, and the lights were dim. And I knew this was going to be bad news once I saw the lights being dim. And he was very nice, very explanatory about the whole thing. But Marie being Marie, when she was told that she had to have a mastectomy, she just said, when can this be done? Mm. So positive, and all the rest of it went with it. She was a very fit and healthy person. Never really ate anything bad, liked her few drinks, okay, but never put any bad food inside her, especially when she was pregnant and all that with the girls. Like, everything was by the book. Mm. But this knocked off her six, because she was quite an attractive looking lady.
She was stunning. She wasn't just quite an attractive looking lady. She was stunning.
Well, she was that all right. She was fairly stunning, all right. But she looked pretty gorgeous that day. But, you know, the colour was knocked out of her face when she was told that she had breast cancer. So, Professor Hill, or Arnie as I'd like to call him, he just said, well, I just can't do the operation straight away, Marie. We have to prepare and make sure everything is right for you. Mm. And she said, why not? She said, I want this out of my body.
Yeah.
And so that's where it all started.
Mm-hmm. And how did you both decide, or did you both decide to tell the girls at that stage, that they were quite young, 13, 10 and 6?
Well, we didn't tell them straight away. Marie wanted to tell her friends, like, she was sort of a ringleader of
the glue in the pot of
all the women in around the Foxhawk area that were all our very close friends. So she decided to ring them, and they said, where are you? By the time we left Vincent's Hospital, it was quite late in the evening, like, well, it could have been 6 o'clock before, and we knew it. Our local hostelry, being the Leberstown Inn, was packed with ladies and their husbands, all rallying around her. And that rally stayed with her right to the end.
Yeah.
And they formed a ring around her like I'd never seen. And I was sort of on the outside of that ring from that day on. Mm. It was like Fort Knox, and you couldn't get inside that ring. Mm. And the girls were dead solid beside her, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dead solid, all her friends. But then we did tell the girls, but they were still very young to understand. Amy was probably the older of the two, of the three, should I say. Sophie was only a baby, 6 years of age. Kate was just a little bit further down the road, but she didn't understand it. And Amy did. And the thing they did want to know was, their mommy going to die?
Yeah.
And the answer was no. But she's going to go through a big operation, so you're going to be with me for a little while.
Yeah.
And so that was it, like, you know. And the operation took place a couple of weeks later. And it was a long operation, because we were going to a football match, and we dropped Marie into the hospital early in the morning. And she was still in the theatre at 6 o'clock that evening, because she had a mastectomy, and she had to have a lot of blood transfusions, and then she had an implant done as well, the same day, reconstruction done the same day, which was a lot to be done. But that's the type of person she was. She didn't want to be, dare I say, disfigured.
I know.
In her sense, she wanted to look like normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably a little bit too much in the one day.
Yeah.
But she was a strong woman, so what she said went.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no say in that end of it. Yeah. So, and being a man, you don't really understand that end of it either, you know. The aesthetics in a woman are very precious.
Of course.
So I just went along with the flow.
Sort of that psychological trauma.
Yeah.
You know, you want to sort of, you know, have, yes, you want the tumour gone, you want cancer gone, but you still want, in a lot of cases, to come back as what you, you know, what you started.
Yeah.
And that's for a lot of people. They do want to have a reconstruction straight away. Sometimes it suits and sometimes it doesn't. It
doesn't, yeah.
You know. And I remember you saying years ago that you bringing the kids into the hospital and saying, by the time the daffodils are back up, mommy will be better.
Yeah.
You know.
And daffodils have a thing with me, because to this day, every time I see the daffodils popping up and then the buds come up and then the flowers come out, I say,
yeah,
this can never leave me.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
feeling and that memory. And I always feel that when the daffodils come out, things are going to get better.
Yeah.
As in, sickness goes, the weather's going to change, yeah. people are going to be in good form, we're starting to get the bright nights back, all of that sort of stuff. And there were dark times, and one of the things that I did was I changed the colour of the house, inside the house. I got rid of everything that was dark, everything, anything that we had blue wallpapers, red colours on, everything, I changed everything to lemons and to cream colours. I just wasn't having this sadness in the house. And it was sad.
Yeah, of course.
Because when we were told Marie was still alive, it was like having a funeral.
Yeah.
It was that upsetting. And now someone had to be strong and not have a tear.
I know.
And that had to be me.
That's tough.
So you have to you bottle all that up inside you. And I'm really only talking about it for the first time like this.
I know.
So it's not the easiest thing in the world. But yeah, someone had to do something. We had to keep the place bright, change colours, change everything. Literally, we changed all the colours in the house. And that took a few bob to do as well. But I mean, it was done and it just got rid of that.
Yeah, that darkness.
Darkness, yeah.
And then I suppose roll on another few years and Marie got sick again. Her cancer had returned and this time had gone to the bones.
Yeah, but before you go there, there was always, she was always in good form until she got to that. And I'll go back to the hospital when she was in hospital. And before it got to the bones and all, and even it got to the bones, right? But then there was a few things that happened. There was the likes of, there was, the guards were doing their exams, and Marie's leg had broken.
That's right.
From the hip to the knee. And at that Monday morning, when she was going down for her operation with Gary O'Toole, and I remember saying that to John, the oncologist, John, Professor John Crown.
Oh, yes, yeah.
John Crown. There's something wrong with her leg. Her leg was as black as anything. And she was only out of hospital, but the bone had cracked.
Okay.
And she couldn't really walk. That weekend, her dad was admitted to St. Francis in Raheny. And it was Sunday night into Monday morning. Marie was having this operation on the leg at 6:30 in the morning. And I get the phone call at 2:00 in the morning saying her dad had passed. Gosh. Amy was doing double maths exams in the Leaving Cert.
Yeah.
And Kate was doing double maths in the Junior Cert. I said, Jesus, what am I going to do? So I decided I wouldn't tell them that the granddad died. But I had to tell Marie. So I rang her early in the morning. Early. I said, look, I can't go down to you because the girls are doing this.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you now your dad has passed. So not the nicest thing to tell you going underneath the operation, but I'm not telling the girls.
I know.
So I had to go to the school, drop them off, and then ask the principal in Loretto. Any phone calls in here, nothing for the girls, if it's their aunties or anything like that. I don't want them knowing anything. Their granddad's just passed and their mum's still doing. So that was all up. But she got through that. And then, you know, she, when it got into her bones and all the rest, and it was just, I knew when they opened the leg that that was it. And I had to find out how long had she got left without telling the girls.
Yeah.
But sort of prepare myself in a way.
True.
That how do I handle this? And the nurses in St. Vincent's were magnificent. They told me no panic, stay calm. They told me what'll happen.
Okay.
And how it'll happen. And they were absolutely fantastic. You know, so that's the thing. But still up to the end, Amy had her Deb's party.
Yeah.
And she wanted to see all the dresses.
Oh, yeah.
And all the girls that were going over class all had to go in with their dresses on.
That was
was that you?
My junior cert results.
All right.
Or something. Yeah. And we went in to the hospital to see her and she had a bottle of Bucks Fizz.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, so nice. Like, Kate, you were what, 16?
15. I was 15 when she died, but I think I was about 10 or 11 maybe when she was diagnosed. Mm. And it's so weird because I was so young, but there's like vivid times that I like remember of her being diagnosed, even though I didn't really understand what was going on. Like when we were in Spain, she was really upset the night that she had found the lump. And we were all out for dinner, and it was a massive big table of us, probably like 30 odd, and all the adults were up the top and all the kids were down the end. And I just remember she was upset before we went out, and like she was trying to hide it from us. But again, throughout the night, I remember I kind of looked up at the table and she was chatting with one of the other women, and I could see she was upset again. And I had gone up to her and I was asking her, like, was she okay? What was wrong? And she just told me that she really missed her sister. One of her sisters lives in New Zealand.
Okay.
She was really close with her sister. So she was just telling me, oh, I really miss Valerie. So I kind of just forgot about it. And then when we got home as well, like I can add up all the times where I started making sense that something was wrong. When we got home, we had the school play was always on in January. But before that, one of the days, I think I couldn't go to rehearsal or like something. Someone had to collect me. Someone different had to collect me from school. And you used to have to tell your teacher, my mum's not collecting me, dad's collecting me, or whatever it was. And the teacher asked me why. And I said, oh, my mum's just in hospital. She's just getting a biopsy. But I didn't know what a biopsy was. I had no clue. I just said it so flippantly. And I remember my teacher going, oh, is everything okay? But she knew I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, yeah. And I just didn't think. But I think then after that, she might have had a word with dad or whatever it was, because she obviously knew. But I remember her face, and it was her face that kind of gave me, okay, something's wrong. And then a couple of weeks later, then the play was on. And I think the mums, the other mums, knew that she was getting tested, and her friends and whatnot all knew. So it was, there was always a few nights of the play. So like mom would go one night, dad would go the other, and then they'd go together or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the night the dad came, I remember we were leaving and it was really busy. And one of the other mums kind of just looked at dad, and dad just kind of like shook his head to say, like, it's not good news. And even though I was so young, I picked up on all these little things. And then, sorry, I've never actually spoken about this.
Take your time.
There was like get well flowers being sent to the house, which is obviously so nice, but just adding up all those little things. Sorry.
You're okay.
Take your time. It is very tough because, as you say, you were going about your daily life, you know, the
and
play,
I was 10.
School. You didn't
yeah.
But then all of a sudden you were starting to put
yeah.
pieces of a jigsaw together, but it wasn't really giving you the full
yeah.
picture.
Like, you underestimate how copped on kids actually are. But then eventually when the word was out and, like, you know, all the flowers, the amount of flowers that were coming to the house, they told us on a Sunday. I remember we were going to Ping's that night. Ping's was a restaurant, Chinese restaurant in Slorgan. You can tell Chinese is like our favourite thing. And we used to go every Sunday. And we were going that night and they called us into the front room. And I think they told Amy first and then they told me. And even though I had like picked up on all those kind of different little things, I still didn't expect to be told what I was told. Like, for example, me telling my teacher, oh, she's gone for a biopsy. I didn't even know what yeah. a biopsy was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't expect it. But then again, we kind of just got on with it. And like we do as a family, like we all went out for dinner that night. And not that we celebrated, but like we always make something out of everything, even if it's a sad time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we just did our normal and went out for dinner and got on with things.
Yeah. And I remember, Paul, you saying to me, you know, your house became sort of the local go-to for everybody that Marie met in Vincent's. If they were travelling, especially if they were travelling a distance and coming for treatment, it was back to Gallagher's, and she'd put them up into various different rooms and sort everybody out. And she really became the go-to person because you were so close, I suppose, to the hospital too.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were travelling, as you say, up from the country. There was no place for them to go.
Yeah.
Other than a coffee shop. And a lot of them would be tired from the travel up and so on. So Marie'd put on soup and the sandwiches and so on and so forth. And there was times I'd arrive in and I wouldn't even know who would be in the house and say, who's that? Who's that? Well, she's travelling back to Sligo, or she's going to Donegal, or she's down to Cork, or she's down to Wexford and so on. Mm-hmm. And they're just having a little rest before they go back. And yeah, she was really good like that. There's one amazing story which I probably haven't mentioned to you. They're in her ward. And the ward that she was in, Kate will probably remember the name of it, because you picked out the wood for her coffin.
Is it St. Helens?
No, no. In St. Vincent's.
It's the same name as her.
Oakline Wood or something like that. Anyway, there was a young girl in there, and this is the type of person Marie was. There was a young girl in, and I saw was wearing the blue pinstripe suits at the time, part of the job, going in and out of different customers, and I'd have the pinstripe suit on. So a lot of people thought, and I bring me work with me, a lot of people used to say, hello, professor, hello, doctor, to me, when I'd be going in and out of the hospital to the wards. And the nurses would all be saying, hello, how are you? And they thought I was a consultant or whatever. And so I used to go in, but there was this young couple, and they were canoodling, for the want of a better word, six beds in the ward, and they were kissing and hugging. And I said, what's going on there? And Marie says, do you know what? They only got married. And I said, geez, no. And she's not well, like, you know. I said, oh, fair enough. So Marie had been talking to them about the girl, I can't remember what her name was, but she was an AIB, from head office, an AIB staff member. And Marie says to her, do you know what you should do now? She says, between now and your next treatment, she says, you need to get away to the sun. You need to get away to the sun. I said, we haven't had a honeymoon yet. You know, blah, blah, blah. So, about 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm looking at Marie, and I said, we're into the hospital. And I says, what's this on my Visa card? This booking of flights, are we going somewhere? And some apartment in Alveria. In Spain. Oh, she said, don't mind that. I said, I have to mind it. Say, what's going on? And she said, do you know the couple that's over there? She said, I booked her and her husband to go to Spain before they have their next treatment. And here's the awful thing about it. She never got that next treatment.
Oh,
she passed away. She was that sick. Wow. And it was one of the bank managers actually told me about it. And I said, I know the person.
Oh, right.
And she was only 27 or 28 years of age. Oh. And that's the type of person Marie was.
Yeah.
You know, she would do that for other people. Mm-hmm. And so she did it, the simple thing, mm-hmm. as well as the more expensive mm-hmm. item. Yeah. But she did that. She'd have all the ladies in. Mm-hmm. And then one particular night, I walked into the house, and the whole room was full. And we have a double room as a living room. And it was just all ladies having a glass of wine or cheese or whatever, crackers, and they were all just chatting. But every one of them, unfortunately, had breast cancer.
My goodness.
And she had met them either in the ward or in oncology.
Yeah.
Having their treatment.
Yeah.
So they were all having a gin wag in about how their life was going on and so on and so forth. Yeah. So there wasn't very much room for me. Mm. So I used to stay in the kitchen.
We actually, I think, adopted her way. Going forward, because we never don't have people over.
Mm.
It's like an open door policy. And we actually second named our house Hotel Gallagher.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are just in and out all the time.
Yeah. But then, and I remember, Kate, we were speaking about this earlier. So, and it's relevant for Breast Cancer Ireland, because our focus this year in 2023 is all about how metastatic matters. Often, you know, these patients who suffer a metastatic disease don't get heard and don't have a voice because they have a stage four diagnosis. But we are seeing lots and lots more people living and living well with cancer.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Marie's cancer spread to her brain, which is, I suppose, from a scientist's point of view, the most challenging part. And it's something that we are very passionate in Breast Cancer Ireland about funding. And we do significant investment into, you know, international collaborations, both in Ireland, in Chicago, etc., in that whole area of brain metastasis, because it's the one area we can't cure. And I think we've got to keep investing in it. We are making headway. We have lots of other clinical trial drugs to help for bone, spine, liver, lungs. But the brain is the one that is the most challenging.
Yeah.
And I know, sadly, you lost your mom, you lost Marie. How did you cope, Paul, in those months and times after that with the girls being so young?
Well, the first thing I had to do, if I can find a funny side of it, was doing my first shop. And I was born and reared in supermarkets and that, down in Dunn's. I hadn't a clue where anything was in Coran's Court. But I couldn't have picked a better night to go down, just to be on the funny side of this, because it is a sad subject. But I went down to Dunn's, got home on the Monday evening, sort of fed the girls, but I was never home before 8 o'clock, so they more or less fed themselves. Went down, started looking around the aisles, and next one of the women says, "You look lost, son." And I said, "I am. Where? Oh, look, you're buying all the wrong things. Come over here and we'll sort you out. So give us a look at your list." And I said, "Oh, it's in my head." And I said, "So tell us what it is." So anyways, they were brilliant. They filled a basket for me, did all the shopping and told me where this to go and that to go and blah, blah, blah. So that was my first thing. But the problem that I had was coping was when it came to the girly stuff, going into the girly aisle and looking at the pharmaceutical side of it and looking around to see was there anyone looking at me, going to pick up certain girly products. Oh, it was terrible. And I remember my pals got me away for a weekend of golf. And talk about getting things mixed up. All the stuff I had in the bag for me was for the girls. So trying to cope, it took me a while to get things sorted out because I used to get the girls and still do their names mixed up. And so the coping part was very difficult because there was a lot of washing to be done and ironing and so on. And me being the type of person I am, I wanted to do it all myself.
Yeah,
I said, right, the girls need looking after and I have to be the mommy now. But the first thing I did was I said, I better lose a bit of weight because otherwise I'm going to go down the tubes. Because when Marie was sick, it was hospital to home to look after the girls and back to the hospital. And you might get home at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, then you had to do ironing, make lunches, so on. So you were eating sandwiches rather than eating a dinner. You were eating, drinking coffees, this, that,
eating on the go.
So 2 and 3 hours sleep max a night. So I went from being a fit 13, 14 stone up to 18 stone 12. I ballooned. So I said, first thing I can do is get rid of this. So I start back to the gym, back training, back blah, blah, blah. And eventually I got myself down there for about a year and a half. I got myself down to about 13 stone, so I was happy enough with that. But then, because the girls took a lot of looking after. Because I had to start doing school runs, which I never did before. And then there was always an argument who could sit in the front and who could this, that, and the other. And Spin FM was on and whatever else with their radio station on. And the only thing I insisted on was that when the sport came on, they all be quiet. So I could listen to the sport in the morning time. But it was good fun. It was very challenging bringing them up. And one of the things I always remember was because, you know, when little girls become of age, Sophie was 10 when her mum passed away. And I said to the girls, now, she's going to become a young woman now in the next year or maybe two. You need to look out for her. And I said, and because I won't notice what's going on. And so when the time comes, look after. Don't have me doing things that I can't handle. So they were great. Amy was like the mommy.
That's right.
And she, whatever she said went with the girls and still is, you know. And I'm sure they probably go to her more than they go to me. to talk about things.
And Kate, how did you feel at that point when your mom had passed? Like, Amy was slightly older, Sophie was much younger. You know, like, how did you kind of come to terms with it, I suppose?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I kind of, even just like the couple of weeks up to her dying, it was kind of as if it nearly took until the very last like few days to actually realise what was happening. Because she had gone, she was in hospital for, I think, was it about 3 months? It was about 3 months before she died. Mm. She'd gone on a trip with her mum and her sister down to
Athlone.
And she was too sick, so they took her back up. And when she got back up, she went into hospital. I think that was in August, the end of August. And when she went in, she never came back out. So we spent like 3 months or so going in and out of hospital. And kind of just never clicked that like she was actually going to die. And I even remember at one point we went in to see her. And when we left, Dad brought us in after school or after work. And when we left, we were getting in the car. And I remember asking him, what are we going to do for Christmas? Like, are we going to come into hospital or like, where are we going to have our dinner? And like, looking back, I obviously gave Dad like the fright of his life when I asked that question, because he didn't want to tell me. Mm-hmm. But it's obviously a realization for him that we didn't know what was going on. And yeah, so it kind of took, it was really only in the last few days before, I remember they moved her out of the ward and they moved her into a room on her own. Mm-hmm. And when it had gone to her brain, then it started taking over. Like, she wasn't as functional when we were going in to see her. And the nurses were telling us to bring in things like photo albums and stuff. Okay. But she was still there, because I remember when we brought in the photo albums, she didn't want to see them, because I think she knew that was kind of, mm-hmm. you know, the end of the line for her. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, I suppose, I was so young. I was hanging around with my friends all the time. Like, the one thing I will say is thank God for friends and family friends. Because I actually don't think like any of us would have made it through without them. Mm-hmm. Like, so many people just swooped in and looked after us. I was at an age where I was kind of like going to discos and going to Wes and all those kind of things. Mm. And I went into transition year. And I remember like I ditched school a lot in transition year. I just didn't want to go in and deal with getting upset and being in school. And Dad was at work, so I got away with it for a lot of the time.
Just by the way, Paul.
But I don't know. I think it's kind of the later years that you start. It's the life events that you really do feel. Like, for example, we got married there in October. And it's not exactly, like, it might not be on that particular day of that event, but even just the small things, you do start kind of getting upset over things around the time of a life event. I remember there was one time, I think it was in, maybe it must have been only a couple of months after Mum died, but I wasn't collected from school, but there was a miscommunication in who was collecting me or whatever happened. And it was quite dark because it was going into winter. And I started walking home and I like bawled my eyes out the whole way home. And I think that's when I realised she was gone. Mm. And it's funny because that could have happened when she was alive.
I know. It just rang more true that she was never going to pick you up again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, as I said, it's the later moments in life that are kind of harder to deal with. I think the more mature I am, the more I do start, you know, she's never coming back. Mm. But we do celebrate her in all of our life events as well. Lovely. Like, she's a part of everything, even though she's not physically there.
I know.
You know?
I know. And I mean, it was lovely. I know Amy, your older sister, has just had her baby girl.
Yeah, Amy just had a baby. Yeah.
Ruby Marie.
Yeah, she named her Ruby Marie. So yeah, she's gorgeous. She's a dote. And we even like that, we think, you know, it's mad. Like, imagine if she was here and she was a granny. Like, yeah, she'd hate to be called a granny.
Totally. Way too glamorous, you know, for that.
And then Sophie, my younger sister, her and her boyfriend bought a house there recently. So they moved into their house down in Greystones. Yeah. So there's just all these kind of life events that you always kind of feel you'd love to show her or talk to her about what's going on. But we have each other as well. So
that's it, which is really, really important.
Yeah.
And I remember, Paul, you saying, you know, oh my God, like, I have three daughters, you know, the amount of tan, the tan on the towels, the tan on the sheets, the tan on the loo. Like, how do people cope with all this? And that was at a time when we totally tangoed ourselves in tan. You know, there was none of this Bare by Vogue.
We actually had myself and Amy set up a spray tanning company called Southside Tanning. And we used to spray tan, like, Dad, there was no say, Dad was not getting any word in it. It was happening and that was it. We used to set up, pop up the tent in the playroom and just spray tan like 20 bodies on a Thursday evening. And they'd all be in drying themselves at the fire with like no clothes on in their little spray thong.
Oh, poor Paul.
I was totally barred out of the house.
He used to just get to the point of not saying anything.
And I suppose, Paul, for you, like, you were running your business. You know, you had these three teenage and younger children. Like, you had to find it really, really difficult and, I suppose, lonely.
Well, it was very difficult, but I had other people involved in the business as well. There was other directors there, but it was really tough, I never looked on it as being tough. Challenging, yes. And I suppose that's probably because of the age I was at. Like, you know, I was sort of, you know, involved in football, Men Don't Cry, all of this sort of stuff. Got involved in all sorts of challenges, as you know. So, was it difficult? Yes. Did I ever look at it as being difficult? No. Did I sleep much? Definitely not. It was the biggest difficulty I had, actually, through Marie's illness, because, you know, you were in bed together at night and she was sore and stiff, and if I lay down in the bed, it was a stubborn horse, so I used to have to sit up straight and try not to move, and I'd have a TV on without sound. So for about 3 or 4 years after it, I just couldn't sleep. So I was, as such now, I don't sleep that much, maybe 3-4 hours a night, maybe 5 if I'm lucky. And that was a big thing I can always remember. It was this, you didn't sleep an awful lot, but the demands of the job were still always there. And then we had a horrible recession that hit as well, and that was just devastating to our business. Yeah, it was difficult times.
And I know you have a massive, massive circle of very good friends over all the years, both your parents and your own girls as well. But did you use those as your support system to talk about how you felt? Or did you ever seek counselling of any kind? Did you find a need to?
Me personally?
Yeah.
No, I never saw it. Probably a mistake I made. I should have had the girls looked after properly, and I didn't, because I wanted to try and do it myself. We did have somebody in, and they did speak to us in the house. I can always remember. I can't remember the lady's name. She was in a few times, but we seemed to cope together. We were close knit, and the girls sort of watched over me, and I watched over them. But it was No, never looked at the counselling regarding talking to people. If you were talking, you would talk maybe just... There's so much going on in life that I very seldom spoke about that. My closest friends, there was probably 4 of us, 6 of us, 8 of us, used to always go out on a Saturday night, whether that be to a restaurant or just to a pub for a few pints or whatever. And I was ending up sitting on the table on my own. And they were really good taking me out. But after a year or so of that, I sort of said, I think I'm going to go out on my own and have a few pints and so on. So I used to vary it, you know. But they were so good to me, like, so good to me, so protective, I suppose, more so than anything else.
And you were probably on a for all the world, a hamster wheel. You know, you didn't have time to reflect. You know,
well, because everything was geared around keeping the house right,
yeah,
keeping the business going, working as long as you could, still involved in the football. And there was all sorts of other things that we did. We set up the cycling, as you know, in Kilmacoe Croaks, and we did all sorts of challenges with fundraising. And so there was always something on the go.
You're not a man to sit around, that's for sure.
Well,
definitely not.
If I sit, I fall asleep. Yeah. So I tend not to. You know. Yeah.
And Kate, how about you? Do you feel you would have benefited from that traditional therapy, or what coping mechanisms did you use?
I did a little bit of, in school they have like guidance counsellors. So initially when Mum passed, I went into the guidance counsellor once or twice, but I just didn't get anything out of it. As well, I was so young, I couldn't really say anything, but I was kind of just sitting there and crying. But genuinely, my friends, and family friends, and family, aunties and uncles, they are the people who actually got me through. I kind of wear my heart on my sleeve. I can't hide my emotions. I do build them up, but then when I'm ready to burst,
yeah,
I burst. But you always feel so much better after just having that kind of conversation with someone, or just chatting to people and just letting people in as well. Like, there's so many people who I would have conversations about, you know, being upset or what's going on in my head or what's going on in just general life, and like, people want to be there for you. So it's not always a case of having to go to a counsellor, even though I don't doubt for a second that they probably do help. And I have thought about it many times, but just having that outlet between, like, people who you can talk to is really helpful. And just sometimes just letting yourself being upset.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird one. I used to go for a quick run around the block before the wedding when I was trying to get myself in gear. And I used to put on my wedding playlist on Spotify. And I don't know what it was, but I always used to just cry. Like, the minute I started running and the minute I started playing the playlist, I'd always cry for the first, like, one or two songs. But I always felt great after it. Like, it was like a happy sad, if you know what I mean. Yeah, so genuinely just chatting to your friends and being open about things, I find is the best kind of outlet for me.
And Paul, I suppose I knew Marina. I didn't know her very well. I'd met her once or twice because you were always great supporters of all that we did for Breast Cancer Ireland. But did she ever have that conversation towards the end and say, you know, make sure, or go and find somebody, or don't you dare go find somebody, mind those girls? Or, I mean, did she ever have that conversation?
Maria wasn't that type of person. She did say to me, 10 months before she passed away, and she was having trouble with this leg of hers, she said, you know, you're going to be rearing these kids. And I said, get that out of your brain.
Yeah.
Get that out of your mind. Did she ever say to me, go and find someone new? No. Certainly did not. And would always be suspicious anyway, about men in general. And that's why she was such a hit with the girls, besides being quite attractive herself. But it's a hard one to say when you have your daughter sitting beside you in an interview. Yeah, I've had a few girlfriends and had one or two nice relationships. But it's been tough, but always the girls came first. And I was a security officer here sitting left of me here that used to watch over me. Because she sat, her room was the first one on the way in.
Mum made my room. I wonder if she did this on purpose. But me and Sophie used to share a room. And before she died, a couple of months before she died, she turned the front downstairs sitting room into a room for me. So I think maybe she was
future-proofing.
So I had to be careful.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Paul and Kate. I mean, this is not an easy topic.
No.
It's not easy for anybody who's gone through this. But I think you've been very open and honest. And I do think that our listeners will get a lot of solace in what you've said and how you've, you know, how you had to deal with the loss, how you had to go through all of Marie's journey and now deal with the loss. And as you say, you know, remembering all the life moments and having her still part of your life.
Yeah. Well,
what I would say, Aisling, just to anyone that may be listening, is that, like, the loss of a loved one, whether it's your wife, your sister, your aunt, your granny, whatever, is not easy to deal with. But what is nice about it is to celebrate their life after they've gone. Mm-hmm. And put yourself in to a position where you can celebrate, like memorising the birthdays, the Christmas, and so on, and still get on with your own life. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to do that as a family. We've never forgotten her, but we've all moved on. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that's the way she would have wanted.
Mm-hmm. And she's always with you.
Yeah,
and she's always
absolutely.
She's always
with and you. Like when Amy had the baby there recently, and we were all a bit nervous about it because she was in labour for a few days, and we were touch and go. In I went to the church. 4 candles were lit, and they were lit for Marie to watch over, thing for her granny, for her granddad to watch over, and the top candle was for Amy.
Yeah,
and what was coming over, which was the new little baby, which has brought it's just a circle
another
of life.
New lease of life, absolutely.
Yeah, so.
But it is amazing how you say that life moments are always remembered. I had a recent conversation with Philip Hannigan, Emma Hannigan's dad.
All right,
and he said to me that a couple of months ago he brought all of the families in for dinner because Emma would have turned 50.
Very nice.
So it is true. Those lifetime moments, you know, are still remembered, and it is important to still remember.
You have to. Like that, it's like, you know, gone but not forgotten.
Absolutely.
You know, like mum's birthday is the 6th of December. So on the 6th of December every year, dad gets the tree and we go over to the house and celebrate the house. So you have to just make the best out of the moments, even though they're not here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, listen, thank you, Paul and Kate.
You're very
Thanks
welcome.
Very much for joining us
thank
today
you.
On More Than a Lump. This episode of More Than a Lump is proudly supported by Care Plus Pharmacy. Care Plus is Ireland's leading community pharmacy brand, offering expert advice and services for a healthier and happier you. You can find your nearest Care Plus on careplus.ie or follow them on social media for daily health and wellness tips.